A Bible Study on 1 Samuel chapter 16, verses 1 through 13. This is my first, and it may be my only, attempt at giving a lecture on a Bible passage for online use. This lecture is not the same as a Sunday school class or a Bible study class, and will not be nearly as beneficial. When we have a class, we have an opportunity to hear other perspectives, other points of view, details we may have missed or overlooked. Sometimes we may get to hear personal testimonies of how a passage has engaged or impacted a person's spiritual journey, brought them closer to God, and reaffirmed God's presence in their lives. A class setting brings an opportunity for exploration and transformation, key tools for spiritual growth and maturity. A class invites participation, not only with the Bible passage, but with other Christians. A lecture is a poor substitute. A lecture may bring information, but it does not give the same amount of energy, engagement, or opportunity for transformation that a discussion brings. Another issue with a lecture of this nature is I can't see your face. I can't see your look of confusion when I'm not making myself clear, or when they are glazing over because I'm focusing too much on history, too much on a language peculiarity, too much on non-biblical traditions or stories, and there is no one to tell me it is time to quit, although you can quit listening anytime you want. As to the lecture, the entire lecture lasts about 24 minutes, and I have already spoken about 2 minutes, so you only have 22 minutes left to go. Also, for those of you who are not interested in how Israel ended up having king, you can skip forward to the time mark of 3 minutes and 20 seconds. If you don't want to hear how we ended up with the book of 1 and 2 Samuel and want to focus only on our passage, you can skip ahead to the time mark of 8:30. That segment only lasts about 5 minutes and ends at 13:30 and is followed by a brief explanation about why David is sometimes considered the 7th son and sometimes considered the 8th son, and that finishes around the 15-minute mark. The lecture ends with an almost 9-minute discussion about why David appears to be the forgotten son and the hated brother. I will begin with a quick review of how Israel ended up with kings. The establishment of the monarchy was an important development in Israel's history and ranks right up there with the exodus from Egypt, the exile, and the return from Babylon. The promise made by God to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12 set into motion a history of salvation that reached its fulfillment with the settlement of the people in the promised land. But God's care for Israel did not end there. New problems and needs arose, and God responded. As we look at Israel's history through the books of the Bible, we see that the book of Joshua centers on how Israel came to possess the promised land, and how by the end of 2 Kings, Israel had lost the promised land. The books of 1 and 2 Samuel describe how Israel transitioned from a tribal society, basically a loose and chaotic confederacy, to a society identified as a country with a king. 1 and 2 Samuel tells how that kingship was established, introducing us to key characters, especially David. And now, a longer review on how the books of 1 and Samuel came to be. Our reading today is from what we call 1 Samuel, but originally the books in our Bible we know as 1 and 2 Samuel were one book. The oldest Hebrew manuscript from the Dead Sea Scrolls includes both 1 and 2 Samuel on a single scroll. The division into two books was probably introduced by Greek translators who created the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Old Testament. Perhaps they were doing that to create scrolls of a more manageable size. In those Septuagint manuscripts, the books of 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings are divided into four books called 1 through 4 Kingdoms. The decisions about where to divide the books was influenced by the custom of concluding books with the death of major figures. For example, the book of Genesis ends with the death of Joseph. The book of Deuteronomy ends with the death of Moses. The book of Joshua ends with the death of Joshua. So they ended 1 Samuel with the death of Saul and ended 2 Samuel with the death of David. Of course, by dividing one scroll of Samuel into two books, we end up with this curiosity. In 2 Samuel, named for the prophet Samuel, Samuel does not appear at all. In 1 and 2 Samuel, the role of personality is central. The figures of Samuel, Saul, and David loom over the story. Samuel is the first figure, and we see him as a central character in 1 Samuel chapters 1 through 28. Saul comes in on the scene on 1 Samuel chapter 9 and lasts all the way through the beginning of 2 Samuel. David enters at 1 Samuel chapter 16 and stays until the end of 2 Samuel chapter 24. All three are presented as crucial to Israel's future. But many times when two of them are present at the same time, tensions and conflict arise, as if there is room for only one of these dominant personalities. In the end, it is David, the man after God's own heart, who fascinates the writers. The telling of these stories depicts the personalities in artistic and theological, as well as historical terms. As in all of biblical literature, it is not just about the truth of fact, but also about the truth of meaning. The story of Israel's transformation from tribe to kingdom is grounded in a historical experience. But the story of this time is peopled by characters that are sometimes portrayed in painstakingly realistic terms, and other times portrayed larger than life. To paint David or any of the crucial characters simply in human historical terms would suggest that Israel's transformation was simply the product of human activity. But 1 and 2 Samuel understand that Israel's new future results from the working of God. It is God who shapes the events and personalities of this time. The issue for the books of Samuel is, where does true power lie? The writers understood that there is a tension between human power and divine will, and God possesses the final authority. From the poetry of Hannah's song in 1 Samuel 2, when she discovers she is pregnant, to David's song and the end of 2 Samuel, right before his death, 1 and 2 Samuel are framed by announcing a divine purpose at work that overturns and reverses the usual patterns of power. Examples are abundant. A barren woman gives birth to the prophet of God's future for Israel. A devastating Philistine victory is turned into a Philistine defeat without human help in 1 Samuel chapters 4 through 6. When the people of Israel demand a king, that demand becomes God's anointed one, Saul, in 1 Samuel chapters 8 through 10. Then we come to the story of David and see how an eighth son becomes the future of Israel and a man after God's own heart in 1 Samuel chapter 16. These are more than just human activities. They are a part of God's will at work to bring Israel's future into being. This also brings us into our passage today in 1 Samuel chapter 16, verses 1 through 13. I am assuming you have read it, and that you have your Bible open to it. Remember, there are a lot of different translations, so sometimes the phrasing and words I refer to may be different than what you have before you. Our passage is the first of the stories of David, and it also marks the final appearance of Samuel. But outside of Samuel's initial objection in verse 2, both Samuel and David are passive participants in this drama. In fact, David does not even speak in our passage. The central actor is God, who enacts his will through Samuel and David. In verse 1, Samuel was told to go see Jesse of Bethlehem to anoint a new king. Now, in the previous chapter, chapter 15, God has rejected Saul as king. But Saul is still technically king, which is why Samuel is concerned and voices his concern in verse 2. Obviously, to anoint a new king when there is already a king sitting on the throne would be considered an act of treason. God comforts Samuel by telling him to take a heifer as a sacrifice. In verse 4, we see that the elders of the city of Bethlehem are also fearful. They do not know that Samuel has come to anoint a successor to Saul, but they do know that Samuel is in conflict with Saul, and they do not want to be drawn into the controversy. Samuel soothes them in verse 5 by telling them his intent is peaceful. And he invites them to consecrate or sanctify themselves and come to the sacrifice. After that, they are no longer a part of our story. By verse 6, we only have Samuel, Jesse, and Jesse's sons present. The sons of Jesse are brought before Samuel one at a time when Eliab, who, as we find out in chapter 17, verse 13, is the oldest, when he comes, Samuel is ready to choose him, but God says no, that Samuel is not really seen. There is some irony here, because if you're familiar with Samuel, then you will remember he was given to the Lord after his time of weaning. And in chapters 3, verses 1 through 2, we are told Samuel served the priest Eli, who could not see, at a time when visions were rare and the lamp of God was dim. Now it is Samuel who cannot see. The reality of God's future for Israel does not always appear clear to human eyes, even to those of a prophet. God sees differently than humans. God sees the heart, meaning the inner person and not the outward appearance. Heart has to do with the will and character of a person. And as we will find out, it turns out David is the man after God's own heart. So now we have a parade of sons coming before Samuel. Although only the first three are named, the other four are lumped together, and we assume they were presented from oldest to youngest. In verse 10, after the seventh son has also not been chosen, in verse 11, Samuel asks Jesse if all of his sons are present. And Jesse reports that there is one other who is tending the sheep. And David's identity as a shepherd foreshadows his role as a king. Shepherd was a common title for kings, both in Israel and in the ancient Near East. It is also significant that David is the eighth son, meaning he is far down in the line of succession. God, as he did with Jacob and Joseph, once again reaches out to take a younger son, an unlikely prospect for success, and finds in him the hope of Israel's future. Once again, God sees possibilities, even when others do not. So the youngest makes his appearance, and though he is passive and never speaks. In verse 12, we are told he is ruddy, has beautiful eyes, and is handsome. So while appearance may not be a determining factor, apparently it also doesn't hurt. And he is anointed before his brothers. And as verse 13 tells us, the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward. It is the first time David is actually named in the whole passage. Is David the eighth son or the seventh son? 1 Samuel 16, verses 10 through 11, clearly states that Jesse had at least eight sons, of which David was the eighth. But But in 1 Chronicles, chapter 2, verses 13 through 15, it indicates that Jesse only had 7 sons, and that David was the youngest. This, of course, raises a question. Which passage is correct? How many sons did Jesse really have? Well, most scholars will point out that 1 Chronicles chapter 2, verses 13 through 15, does not state that Jesse only ever had 7 sons. It simply names 7 of his sons, including David, and 2 sisters of the sons, which, by the way, aren't mentioned as daughters of Jesse, but as sisters of Jesse's sons. The traditional argument is that it is most likely one of Jesse's sons had died before being married, or died without having had any children, or died without ever having done anything particularly noteworthy. It would not be unusual, then, for his name to be omitted from the written record in 1 Chronicles. But now, why is David the forgotten son and the hated brother? For this part of the lecture, please read Psalm 69. So please hit the pause button and give yourself time. Now that you're back, while some believe that this psalm contains prophecies about Jesus Christ, his rejection by his family, and how he was given vinegar to drink on the cross, there are others who think this psalm is a reflection of David's life as a child. They point to a Jewish tradition that explains why David was not presented before Samuel, and while he was treated so rudely by the eldest brother Eliab in 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 28. According to this tradition, Psalm 69 is full of pain, rejection, and hardship because David was considered an outcast among his family. They say that David grew up in a family in which he was despised, rejected, shunned, and outcast. He was treated with scorn and derision, Psalm 69, verses 7 and 8. The community followed the example of the family and assumed that David was full of sin and guilt, Psalm 69, verse 11 and 12. If something turned up missing, they believed he stole it and forced him to replace it, Psalm 69, verse 4. He was often the object of jokes, pranks, filling his plate with gall and his cup with vinegar, Psalm 69, verses 20 and 21. Remember, he is the youngest and likely was the subject of all kinds of bullying. But why? Why did David's family reject him? The traditional Jewish answer is that they thought David's mother had committed adultery and bore him out of wedlock. They thought he was a bastard. In fact, the word stranger in Psalm 69, verse 8, has the same Hebrew root as mudzar, meaning bastard. As we know, David's father Jesse was the son of Obed, who was the son of Boaz, who married Ruth the Moabite woman. The Jewish traditional law explicitly forbade Hebrew women from marrying Moabite men because of how the Moabites had treated the Israelites when they were wandering in the desert after fleeing in Egypt. But the law was unclear about whether or not a Hebrew man could marry a Moabite woman. Boaz believed that the law allowed such a marriage, which is why he married Ruth. However, according to Jewish tradition in the Midrash, Boaz died on the night that he and Ruth were married. Many believed that his death proved that God had condemned Boaz's marriage to Ruth and had punished him accordingly. However, even though Boaz and Ruth had only been intimate for that one night, she conceived and gave birth to Obed. Obed was then viewed as illegitimately born, as was his own son Jesse. Nevertheless, both of these men labored hard in learning the Torah and loving God, and so the conduct of their lives helped convince the surrounding communities that though Boaz had sinned, They themselves were accepted by God as part of the covenant community. Jesse married a Jewish girl named Nisbeth. After Jesse had been married for many years, he had fathered 7 sons with Nisbeth and had gained honor as a righteous man and a spiritual leader in the community. Doubts began to fill his mind, though, about whether or not his line and his seed were permanently polluted by his Moabite blood. It was at this point that he resolved to cease all relations with Nisbeth. He did this out of love for her, because she, as a pure Israelite, would be sinning to be married to someone who was of impure Moabite ancestry. Furthermore, Jesse began to doubt the legitimacy of his 7 sons. If he was impure, then his children were illegitimate and impure as well. So Jesse, wanting a legitimate heir, came up with a plan to have a son in the same way that his forefather Abraham had done, through relations with his wife's Canaanite maidservant. Whether Jesse was viewed by God as a true Israelite or just as a Moabite convert to Judaism, the law allowed him to marry a female convert to Judaism. If he obtained a son from this union, his son would be recognized by all as a legitimate heir, and thus securing Jesse's family line. When the Canaanite woman was told of this plan, she did not want to participate, for she loved Nisbeth and had seen the pain that she had gone through from being separated from her husband for so many years. So she told Nisbeth about Jesse's plan, and the two of them decided to do what Laban had done so many years earlier with Leah and Rachel. So on the night that Jesse was to have relations with the Canaanite maidservant, she switched places with Nisbeth. And on that night, Nisbeth conceived, and Jesse remained ignorant of what had taken place. But as the months went by, Nisbeth began to show that she was with child. And her 7 sons, as well as her husband, all believed that she had committed adultery. The sons wanted to kill their adulterous mother by stoning, as the law called for, and her illegitimate baby with her. But out of love for his wife, Jesse intervened. Nisbeth did not reveal to her husband that the child was his, for she did not want to embarrass him by revealing the truth of what had happened. Instead, she chose to bear the shame of their son, much as her ancestress Tamar had prepared to be burned rather than bring public shame upon Judah, her father-in-law and the father of her child, in Genesis chapter 38, verses 24 and 25. As a result, David grew up in a family in which he was despised, as described in Psalm 69. It was also said that all of the great qualities of Boaz were to be found in Jesse and his 7 sons, while all of the despicable traits of Ruth the Moabite were concentrated in David. The tradition is that this is also why David's family forced David to be the shepherd in the fields by himself. They were hoping a bear or a lion might kill him. This might also help explain why later in life, when David was fleeing from a murderous Saul, David asked the king of Moab to harbor his mother and father in 1 Samuel chapter 22. According to tradition, one of his brothers was also protected there. Of course, a couple of years later, when David becomes king of Israel, he slaughters 2/3 of the Moabite army. Why? Well, again, according to Jewish tradition, this was because after David had left his 3 family members there under the protection of the king of Moab, that king killed David's father and mother, but left his brother alive, 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 2. So when David becomes king, he retaliates by killing 2/3 of all the soldiers of Moab. And finally, this may also explain why David, when he was confessing his own adultery relationship with Bathsheba, he says, "In sin my mother conceived me." Psalm 51, verse 5.